Court of Appeals. Your panel today is, to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Bob McCoy. I'm Leanne Dofino. We have three cases set for oral submission on the 130 docket. And it's my understanding that one of the lawyers has not arrived. Danielle, if she doesn't show up in a reasonable time and we don't hear anything and you want to just leave, that's fine. Or if you want to be the only one to argue, that's fine too.
The staple way the opposing counsel is not here. So if you want, if it's the court's pleasure to push us to third to give her a chance to make it, that's fine too.
Well, we're going to push her to third, but if we don't hear from her within a reasonable time, we'll just give you the word and you can go on.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. So we'll hear the either two or three cases, and then we'll take a break before our 3 o'clock docket. All right. I understand both sides are ready. So, Megan, would you call the case, please?
The court will now call Walker versus Campuzano. May it please the court, Ms. Vicki Brennan to argue for appellant, and Mr. Andrew Siever to argue for the Campuzano party, and Mr. Brent Dyer to argue for Carrizo Oil and Gas.
All right.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. We're here on a matter that has an interesting context, and it's certainly interesting in relation to Tarrant County. Our clients, Mr. Walker and Mrs. Walker, who I am proud to be here to represent, own some property in Tarrant County that they subsequently sold to All American Quarter Horse. This occurred in 1979. At that time, the status of mineral rights in Tarrant County were known. But the problem was they didn't have the technology nor the economics, therefore, to drill. In 2007, when Mr. Walker was in the hospital recovering from a serious illness, he saw a story about drilling now occurring in Tarrant County for the Barnett Shale oil. And once he was well enough to investigate, he went out to look at the property that he believed he had owned the mineral rights on and discovered there was, in fact, drilling going on. He undertook some investigation on his own and believed that there had been a horrible error by someone not contacting him about his mineral rights. We are essentially here today because of those mineral rights that he believed he retained back in 1979. In the case before you, we are here on a summary judgment that was granted as a final summary judgment by the trial court. Our first issue on appeal is that was not a proper order from the standpoint of the fact that it was designed and styled as a final order. If you will reference tab 1 of appellant's brief, you will see the order. And you can tell pretty much what happened, that both parties had filed summary judgments. The judge took one of the proposed orders, rewrote it, and submitted it to the party sometime after we argued the summary judgment motion.
All right, well, let me start you out with a procedural question. You
sure.
On page 6 of your brief, no mention is made of plaintiff's claims for fraud, fraudulent inducement, or statutory fraud. In the previous sentence, talks about Carrizo. I don't read you pleading fraud, the inducement, or statutory fraud against Carrizo.
We did not. That was pled against Campuzano's.
Okay. All right. So the fact that it doesn't mention it is because you didn't plead it, right?
I'm sorry?
The reason that the order doesn't mention those clauses of action is because you didn't plead them.
Oh, yes, we did, Your Honor. In the first amended... No. Carrizo, it's the conversion, trespass, and unjust enrichment that are in the order that were not in the in their motion for summary judgment. In other words, because it wasn't in the summary judgment, it wasn't argued.
As I'll go into that next question. My recollection of reading their motion is that, in fact, it appears in the first paragraph of the final paragraph.
Of
specific words.
Of Carrizo?
Uh-huh.
Okay. It was pled by word, but then they never argued any of the grounds or any of the elements for those issues.
Well, but if I think what they said basically was that if you don't own the property, there can't be any unjust enrichment or any of these other three causes of action.
I understand that, Your Honor. Our argument was that if all you're going to do is plead it, but you don't establish the grounds, even if you believe that those grounds wrap within the primary objective, that those grounds still have to at least be discussed and at least have to establish the elements of those grounds. Because what if...
What would be the point of sending it back for trespass when they can't trespass if you don't own it? What's the point of that?
I understand that, Your Honor. What we believed was that if we own the rights, then those things are contingent. And since we argue that the summary judgment was... we do not believe had factual sufficiency anyway, then we feel like all of those things come back into play.
Well, certainly, if you own the property, then
correct,
you have a cause of action for all these, but if you don't own the property, those things go away and this doesn't make any difference.
I understand, Your Honor.
All right. So you're in agreement with that. Okay. You also said that all parties, I'm on page 12 of your brief, all parties pled the possibility of ambiguity in constructing the deed. I didn't read where, for example, Carrizo pled ambiguity.
Your Honor, they did not use the word originally, but we believe that they brought it up from the very beginning. Because while they say, and I will, let me.
How do you bring it up other than in the plea?
I'm sorry, by using the words. What they did was they said right off the bat, take a strict construction approach, and then. They used all sorts of grammatical hoops in order to do it. So from that standpoint, we believe that that's essentially arguing ambiguity, sort of that a duck is a duck.
All right. Well, why don't you just get right to the point. The elephant in the room is Dewey, so why don't you discuss it?
Okay. In the Dewey issue was brought up by a defendant, and they believe that that eliminates the warranty claim. Give me 1 second to pull that out and move to that part of the argument.
I mean, that's their lead dog, so let's discuss it.
Sure, I just wanted to build up to it.
Well, we've read everything.
Sure, and I understand that, and we appreciate that. We appreciate that. Sure. If you will look at the handout that I have given you, you will see the top paragraph is the actual exception clause that was in the deed. The second paragraph that you see was one of the options offered by the appellees as a construct after you did all the grammatical hoops. If you take their thought process to the next point and say, okay, if that's what you want to do is wipe out all the commas, use the antecedents, the precedents, the prepositional phrases, take out whatever you want to do. Essentially, what you have left is at the end. But that being said, when you talk about Dewey, you first have to talk about where we were on this. What we had was a carve-out of the conveyance, save and accept. You don't get that unless you already have it.
Right. We'll agree that in both situations, Dewey, you've got half.
Right, exactly.
We're trying to convey something to somebody else, so we start off the second.
Exactly.
All right.
Okay. Okay. And then, after you have the carve-out, you have the reservation. The reservation is what we've maintained, and the save and accept is the notice saying, whoa, before you think you're going to get whatever, here's the rest of the story. And so, in Dewig, the problem was, were you conveying more than you owned? And that's what happened in Dewig. They tried to convey more than they owned. That is not the case here. In this case, we have the McGinty to Walker reservation, where the McGintys reserved one half. Then we come to the Walker reservation, where they reserved one half. They reserved the one half that they owned. In other words, they're still 100% of the mineral rights. And there is never a problem with all of the mineral rights being conveyed or main or reserved, as long as you stay within the 100% context.
How is that different from Dewey? I've got the old musty book right here. And it says in the opening paragraph that the grantor retained an undivided one-half interest in all the mineral rights. Well, that's what the discussion is here, save and accept one-half of all oil, gas, and other mineral rights. So I'm missing the distinction.
I understand, but there was a little bit more to that. I need to get one more thing. I apologize.
Okay. And just to give a heads up to the other side, same question. It's going to be y'all. Soon y'all think this is the spotted dog.
Okay. In Duig, there was a tract of land that was conveyed, and then Duig subsequently conveyed the land to another party by the deed. The question there was whether Duig reserved for himself the remaining one half or merely one half of the original interest. In this case, to avoid the Duig rule, as we have constructed it, you have to have the reservation by the grantor and the exception clause to provide the reservation. And that's what we just talked about. You have the exception clause, which carves out of the conveyance. That's the save and accept. And then you have the reservation clause, which reserves it to the walkers.
But see, that's where I'm not following you, because the clause says further down, reserved under Jesse McGinty, Republic National Bank of Dallas, W.E. McGinty. So it looks like when it says reserved one half, then it's going on and saying reserved under. So it's looking like the reserved is referring to that reserve.
And I certainly understand your position, and that's one of the reasons we believe that this is ambiguous. If you start dealing with the punctuation and the commas, that also could mean, because of the way adverbial phrases work, that also could mean reserved in reference to the right of ingress and egress, not the mineral rights themselves.
So you're saying that the reserved phrase only modifies the phrase right behind it, right of ingress and egress, and does not modify the previous three lines?
Yes.
That's your position.
That is our position. If you want to have a grammar lesson, I'm a former English teacher, and this drafting is not how I would like it either, but I think that's part of the ambiguity. But if you look at the together with, that's an adverbial phrase, and we believe that the reserve then goes back to that and then goes back to the beginning. But
then the problem with that is that it says, indeed, to Bill J. Walker, dated October 26, 1978, and gives the recorded in volume, which that deed does more than just reserve a right of ingress and egress.
And that's an absolutely exceptional point, and that is possible. And we know that the way these are read, and this court itself in McGee and other cases has said that there are no magic words. You can look at it several different ways. You have to look at the whole thing. I mean, all of that we have talked about before. But when you can read it more than one way, that does create an ambiguity, and it also defeats summary judgment by that context where a trier of fact has the option to make that determination.
Together so, with the right of ingress and egress is a...
I'm sorry?
Isn't that parenthetical?
Yes, ma'am, but if you look at the parentheticals, the problem with the way this is, there are so many commas. Now, grant, in a better world, there should have been some semicolons and some colons and maybe a period here and there so that it was absolutely clear how all of this should construct. But if you start taking out all of the parentheticals, you end up with the results that you see that the appellees have offered in other forms on that demonstrative I handed you. And what the problem with that is that if the court also says, we must consider everything. You said that in McGee, and you've said that in so many other cases, that when you start eviscerating to understand it, then you're not getting there. Yes, in many instances, parentheticals are additional information about the prior noun, but they're used in lots of other ways. So our reasoning is, whether the court appreciates it or not, is that when you look at this, and we can come up with different constructs, when that happens, as long as they're both plausible and reasonable, it is essentially an element that defeats the summary judgment. But he says, hereby reserved one half.
And if it said in grantor, you'd be spot on.
You are exactly right. It doesn't say grantor.
It also doesn't say hereby reserved. It says there is hereby reserved in and under said land, blah, blah, blah. So that's a little bit different, too. I mean, it's not saying save and accept, hereby reserving, or hereby reserves, grantor hereby reserves. It says there is, which seems to refer to the prior deed as well.
Also another construct from what either one of us have argued, which to me is another indication that there is some ambiguity there. Okay, and my response to that was Duig was a three-party chain of conveyances, and this is just two, and that as long as the situation is that there is not an over-conveyance, in other words, it's not 110% or 113%, as long as it remains at 100% of the mineral rights, half are the McGinty's, the other half were reserved by the Walkers to themselves, we don't have a Duig issue. My time has elapsed. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. I'm waiting for the light. May it please the court. I'm Brent Dyer. I'm here on behalf of the Carrizo defendant. I'm going to handle the Duig issue, which I think is what the court wants to hear about. And then Mr. Siebert's going to handle the ambiguity issue, although I kind of get a feeling I might be on the hot seat a little longer. But I absolutely agree with what the panel seems to be saying, which is this looks like a Duig case. And I want to explain just briefly the way I understand Duig, and I think it's the way all the other courts that have followed Duig understand it as well. In Duig, there was an original conveyance, and this is a three-party conveyance like any other. There's always three parties involved in a Duig case. That's the way it works. There are three parties in this case. In Duig, Duig gets a conveyance for all the property except one half of the minerals. He then later conveys that property to someone else, and he says, I'm giving you all the property, save and accept one half of the minerals. And Justice McCoy, you raised the point, well, If the parties in this case had said, and I reserve for myself one half of the minerals, that would be different. Well, actually, it wouldn't. In Duig actually said, I retain for myself. Grantor retains an undivided one half interest. And the Supreme Court said that's not good enough because here's the problem. You're doing a warranty deed. You're warranting how much title you're giving to the property. If you warrant that you are giving all of the property less one half interest, and that's all you have, you have nothing else to retain. And so you can't, on the one hand, say, I'm giving all the property except one half interest that I'm carving out, and then later say, oh, by the way, I also carved out for myself a one half interest. You would be breaching your warranty. So rather than have a conveyance where you actually are told you're getting one half plus half all the property plus one half the minerals, and later you don't, and now you sue for breach of warranty, the Supreme Court said, we're going to collapse that whole process. And if you've warranted that you're going to give this much title, and that means that whatever you thought you kept, we're going to have to go into some part of that to give to the grantee so that you fulfill your warranty, if that's what we have to do, that's what we're going to do. And we're going to do it at the we're going to do it with regard to the conveyance. We're not going to create a breach of warranty claim where we can just solve it by the conveyance. That's what happened to Duhigg. It's what happened here. The Walkers in this case got the property, and they got all of the property less one half of the minerals. They then provided a warranty deed to the predecessor of the Campuzanos, and in that warranty deed they said, we're giving you all the property less one half of the minerals. That's all they had to convey. That's all they could have conveyed, and they can't now breach that warranty by coming back later and saying, oh, well, what we really meant to do was keep half of the minerals or one half of the minerals for us. We just didn't tell you what we were giving you. That would be a breach of warranty. Rather than create a breach of warranty under Duhigg, the trial court did what it was supposed to do and said, your warranty was you were giving all the property less one half of the minerals. That's all you had. So you conveyed away everything you had. You can't now come back and claim an interest. You were stopped from coming back here to court and telling us, oh, I never meant to do that, the deed's ambiguous, or whatever arguments they want to try to make to somehow create an interest that they never reserved. You conveyed what you had. You warranted that's what we were conveying. We're going to make you stick to your warranty, regardless of whatever arguments you might want to make that you somehow kept something. This is exactly a Duhigg case. In fact, it's so difficult. I can come up with no distinction, and I didn't hear opposing counsel offer any distinction between this case and the Duhigg case. It is factually almost identical to Duhigg. There is no material issue that would cause material difference in facts that would cause this court or the trial court to somehow follow a different result than what happened in Duhigg.
And where in the deed here does it talk about what is being conveyed without me having to roll my eyes?
It's in the record. It starts on page 34 of the clerk's record. You got to go to it. It's right there at the bottom of the page. There's some things crossed out. But then it says, have granted, sold, and conveyed, and by these presents do grant, sell, and convey. What?
Am I on tab 2, the appendix to the Carrizo brief?
Yes.
All right.
I think that's correct.
See a paragraph that begins with, but it expressly agreed.
Well, that's hang on.
Have I gone too far?
I'm on the bottom of page 34. You're past. It's below that.
Okay.
There's a big white space, and then there's some language crossed out, X'd out, and all this prefatory stuff up above explains. It's all the legal language and explains who the grantor is.
All right, I'm giving you a tract of land.
Okay. Yeah. Have granted and convey the following described real property, and it has the description. So I'm giving you all of this real property. Here's the legal description of what I'm giving, and then as warranties do in warranty deeds, it then says, but wait. I'm not giving you all the property. I'm not going to tell you the parts of the property that I'm not giving you so that there's no question about what you're getting. You go to page 35 then, and it says, first, there's a reference to some conditions and restrictions in a prior deed that have nothing to do with this case. But then it says, save and accept. So we're still explaining what the warranty is. We're still carving out the warranty of all the property. We're giving you all the property, but I'm going to tell you what you're not getting. Save and accept, and then it describes a one-half interest. If the Walkers were retaining any interest, they would have had to also accept their interest in this warranty, or they would breach their warranty. They only had half the interest. If they were keeping all of their half interest, they would have to say save and accept the rights in all minerals, or save and accept the half interest that was reserved under the McGinty deed and the half that we're reserving for ourselves. But they have to, in the warranty, they have to explain what they're not giving. In this case, what they've delineated as not giving is one half of the minerals. If I'm not giving one half, then I must necessarily, I'm giving all except one half of the minerals, I'm necessarily giving one half of the minerals. Because we have to equal up to a whole. So they carved out one half of the minerals. They only had one half of the minerals. If they're giving all less one half of the minerals, or another way to put it, I'm giving you all the surface and half the minerals. If that's all they had to convey it away. In that case, they would have had all the Campuzanos would have gotten all the surface because the Walkers had that to give. They would have gotten half the minerals because the Walker had that, and they would have a breach of warranty claim against the Walkers for the other half because the Walkers had warranted that they were giving all the property, and they didn't have all the property.
Okay. How's he doing on time?
Okay, well, I just have one brief issue, just on the summary judgment. I think the court understands where we are on this. We did raise the issue. It was in our motion. The argument the Walkers make is that we didn't adequately brief it. We didn't talk about it enough. That's not the standard. The standard is, did we give them notice, the Walkers notice, that we were seeking summary judgment on all the claims? We did. The reason why summary judgment is available on all those claims is obvious and self-apparent. There would be no reason to waste time briefing that issue. The court made the right decision based on what we'd asked for in the motion, and it was adequately presented and it was a valid basis for summary judgment. No, it's not.
You have to set out the order.
It's traditional.
Okay. May it please the court. I want to first of all address something. It has been alleged in both, and Justice McCoy, you've hit on it. It's been alleged both in the appellant's brief and their reply briefs that all parties pled ambiguity. That's simply not the case. The court's record at page 2 and 3, as well as page 165 and 166, contain the answers of the various defendants herein. That's never been raised as an affirmative defense. It's never been pled in any meaningful way. We did address it, obviously, and we briefed it, and that's a far cry because our position is, in briefing it and addressing it, that there is no ambiguity. So it's a far cry from us taking something and trying to put a stake through its heart rather than saying we actually pled it. So from our position, it has been our consistent position that there is no ambiguity in this deed. As far as the language itself, both the trial court and some of the justices on this panel have also pointed out that there can only be an ambiguity if the other side's interpretation. It's not just a matter of coming up with some sort of, hey, this is what we think it means, or this is a possible explanation. It has to be a reasonable explanation. And if you suggest that one half, the reservation of one half, actually applies to the Walkers, then that's the problem, because it appears then that the only thing you're reserving for the McGinties is this right of ingress and egress, which of course is part of the original mineral reservation anyway. That's subsumed in that mineral estate, which would make that meaningless. And so to this day, we don't think we've heard a reasonable alternative explanation such that there is an ambiguity in this language. The other side has mentioned Morrison. We think Morrison is instructive simply for the proposition of this is what you do with it. If there is an ambiguity, the devil's in the details. The Morrison deed that's discussed has very different language than what's in this one. And moreover, not only does it contain language now owned by, which is different than what's here, that was actually underlined in the deed. And so we think that that's important from an intent standpoint. The grammatical, we probably over-briefed that issue, quite frankly. If whether we take away this prepositional phrase or not, it doesn't change the meaning. We did that because in Criswell, the court said that's an appropriate rule of construction. We thought that it made the intent of the parties in the language of the deed easier to understand. Like I say, I think perhaps we overbriefed that to the extent that sort of raised some issues that aren't really there. The other issue is in looking at this deed and in trying to determine the intent of the parties and whether there's an ambiguity, I think it's important on page 35 of the record, there's not a question that the Walker's attorney knew how to reserve an interest for themselves. The clerk's record, or actually it's under tab 2 of Carrizo's appendix, probably the easiest way.
Okay.
If you look at page 35, down the very last paragraph, it says it is expressly agreed that the grantors herein, expressly reserve and retain for themselves their heirs and assigns the vendor's lien as well as the superior title. So there's no question that whoever drafted this deed knew how to protect the interest of the grantor. That's exactly what they did with this language in the vendor's lien. If that language had appeared up at the top, then their interpretation, their argument for ambiguity certainly may make more sense. The fact that that language so clearly reserving their interest in the vendor's lien appears actually argues against their interpretation. As far as we don't have a difference in opinion as far as we agree if there is no interest in these other issues, the trespass and those claims go away. Sort of shocked that those things weren't pointed out to the trial court and given an opportunity. We raised the issue in our reply brief that the proper thing to do would have been to file a motion to reform the judgment. That wasn't done. We did not brief those issues, and we did not plead those issues as Carrizo did. We think it'll be a simple matter. The Campuzano defendants in our motion for summary judgment did not address trespass to title.
You're going back.
Well, I believe that's probably appropriate. In that regard, our position would be that the language probably would simply be to delete the last two sentences of the court's judgment, which addresses, as to the Campuzano defendants, which addresses the trespass causes of action, and then also obviously says this is a final judgment as to those.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm hearing you about reforming the judgment. Procedurally, what difference does it make? I mean, it's, you don't have a summary judgment on those issues as to Campuzano, so you're suggesting remand it with a reformed judgment as opposed to just remanding it to let the trial court fix its judgment, or what are you suggesting?
I'm suggesting that as to the Campuzano defendants, it basically either be reformed to read that they only have we only have a judgment as to the trespass to try title issues. Know if I need to see it any time. All right. If there's no other issues, that'll conclude. Thank you.
Is there a rebuttal?
A brief one, Your Honor.
All right.
In a return to the Dewey issue, which I think becomes the most common defense that is raised to any mineral rights issue, and I'm not saying that's necessarily without merit and with great respect to the court, if we could line every single one up so that the words were identical, whether it's Dewey, Morrison, or this case, this would be very simple. We might not even be here. But what we've got are these minor little distinctions that keep changing. In Dewey, the word that was the focus was retain. Was retain the same thing as reserve? Did it mean they were keeping it and they went through a dictionary evaluation as well? In Morrison, which we also briefed, that's a Waco court, which I realize is not this court, but they dealt with the same thing. And there was an argument over two different issues that because it was such a narrow construct of the same two words, the court said it was clearly a fact issue and it was not sufficient to defeat summary judgment. That's been briefed very fully in our reply brief based on the response of the appellees. But I think if you go back to the same issues, I don't think you can call this a Dewey case because this isn't Dewey. In other words, what the courts will do is take those same facts and apply that. In this case, what you have is the carve-out, the reservation, and the half-mineral rights. The Walkers retained no more than what they owned. They referenced the former deed. They discussed ingress and egress, but whatever the construct was, we believe that one interpretation of this deed is that they made that reservation and that they gave notice of the reservation through the save and accept clause, which is a longstanding precept. We know that there's a long line of cases that take the exceptions and the reservations and they get all mushed up, even not in this court, but in other appeals courts, they get all mixed up and they start even calling them all the same thing. But that's not what happened in this court. This court in Maggie and other cases has said every word matters, but you don't need magic words. It says that we have to read the whole thing, not parts. And we read it the way it is. On the first step, we believe that the way this reads, and it read to our client, and it read to us when we looked at it, is that it is an acceptable interpretation that they believe that they had retained the mineral rights. We thank you very much for your attention.
Columns of Dewey, this case, and tell us exactly why it's on point. You've done more than that, and she has to refute it, but although she's the appellate, you're the one who brought it up. So you go first, and then you respond to him, and you point out in the same fashion why Dewey doesn't apply. In my mind, that's what this case is about. So how long would you need to, let's say no more than three pages, how long would you need to?
I guess I'm the two column, I'm not sure you remember the two columns.
Well, the Dewey case has this, and
right.
This case has this, and that's why they're the same.
Oh, you see, is the court asking us to basically do a comparison?
Right.
I'm
not saying the whole three pages has to be that, but tell us exactly why Dewey applies, and I'm suggesting to you if part of it was a column and a column on point, then we could see, this is the same, that's the same.
Do you need to do that? I can get that to the court. In 7 days, so next Tuesday.
Okay, that's fair. You said 3 days, I was going to tell you your associates would not vote. All right, how long do you need to respond if you get it in your hands, faxed to you next Tuesday?
I would like the same amount of time.
Okay, that's fine.
Your Honor, would you like both of us to prepare that or one submission?
Y'all are in bed together, so it can be from y'all.
All right. Thank you.
I mean, unless you see something that you don't agree with, and I guess then you could respond to, but I can't imagine you not agreeing with what he said. So if you disagree with what he says, then you've got the same period of time that she has to disagree with. All disagreements have the next 7 days.
Thank you.
Is that okay?
Absolutely.
And we file these as supplemental briefs?
That's fine.
Okay.
Supplemental letter brief. It can be a letter. We're not talking about burning down trees to get the covers and the plastic. And just a letter.
Okay.
All right. Your case is submitted. You are excused. Go about your business. Hang around and watch the next argument if you want to.
Thank you.
Your case is submitted. Thank you very much. We appreciate your argument. Now, Danielle, are you going to want to argue after all?
No, Your Honor, I promised Andy I would take notes during his case.
I gotcha. All right.